Hey, Connor.
Hey, Alex. Welcome.
Thanks. Good to be here.
I don't think we've got any choice, do we? We're employed here.
Well, I don't.
All right. So this is the first of our weekly podcasts looking at some of the happenings in the energy sector and in other areas where we've been involved in legal work. And we're going to conduct these podcasts every week, and there's no particular order to the topics that we're going to look at. So Alex, you want to start off with what was the major piece of work that we've been doing over the last couple of weeks, and which topic do you want to talk about first?
Well, in compliance quarter this week, I guess the order of the day was performance reporting. So we were helping out a lot of retailers with submitting their performance reports, having a look at all the indicators, hardship, phone call response times, customer complaints, and so on.
And tell me, how quickly should a retailer pick up the phone?
Oh, it's pretty technical, but at least within the first 30 seconds, I think. And 85% of calls should be picked up within 30 seconds. Yeah, the AER doesn't like people waiting on hold.
Okay, thanks. So the next reporting is for the quarter ending October. Is that right? Or September?
For performance? Yeah. But and the next report submitted will be compliance at the end of next month.
Yeah. All right. And so moving on to some of the compliance work that we've done, we looked at the new energy tech consumer code, and the ACCC yesterday published a draft determination. So the code looks to regulate behind the meter solutions and products. It's got a pretty wide definition of the types of products and services that would be covered by the code. They include power purchase agreements, electric vehicle charging services, and microgrids.
Right, because we get a few inquiries about all those things, don't we?
We do, and so we should be across it.
There's not that much regulation, like with charging stations and everything. Like, it sort of gets a mere mention in the network guideline of the AER. But what, like, in terms of this definition, you say it's pretty broad and ambiguous. Like, why is that?
Yeah, I guess, you know, a trend that we've been seeing lately is the introduction of new terms that are where new terms are probably not needed. So this code in particular, probably with little consequence, but doesn't use the terms that are defined in the National Energy Retail Law. It refers to, in respect to products and services, refers to whether or not those products or services are connected to the grid, and it has two locations where it's referring to, well, talking about how you determine whether that's the case. But I don't think it was the intention for the code to operate in a prescriptive manner, and codes like this are voluntary. So the other similar code relates to the solar industry, and this code would it's proposed to have the same code administrator, which is the Clean Energy Council. And basically it just sets out a whole bunch of conduct that is expected from the initial phases of advertising and marketing a particular product all the way through to contracting. So it's intended to supplement the existing consumer protections, and the ACCC were pretty happy with it.
Right, because we get a few inquiries, and we've done a few, I guess that Clean Energy Council solar accreditation for some solar companies, and that's a voluntary code as well, right? So customers sort of have a bit more confidence that, I guess their energy solution provider is going to be acting within the consumer law, and they'll get an assurance that they have these extra protections. Is that the idea?
Yeah, I think the ACCC says that they think that it might be a bit of a competitive advantage to people who sign the code, and that's obviously based on consumers having a perception that people who sign the code uphold better business practices and offer greater consumer protections than non-signatories. But it's an interesting one because it relies on participation from major players, and it relies on a consumer's perception for it to really have any force. It also, I guess, in a sense, has the consequence that not only in some ways we've got kind of double up of regulation, but I guess it, once it's implemented, there's an argument that it's a self-regulation mechanism that may do away with the need for too much more additional regulation in the traditional sense.
Right, and just a last one on that, how have you seen that play out with the solar provider equivalent? Do you think that's been effective in achieving those outcomes?
I think it's been effective in the sense of the consumer perspective. One thing that I found interesting was that there was a group of people who submitted on this draft code who were unhappy in particular with the CEC. But I guess it's a difficult position for the CEC to be in because they're not necessarily always going to make decisions that everybody is happy with. They have this sort of independent role in respect to administering those codes, and the consequence of non-compliance, really it's just about removing people from being covered by that particular code, so almost removing that tick of approval in a sense.
Right. And can I just go back to something you touched on at the start of talking about this new code, and that's like this sort of these cross definitions, and we've got so many regulatory instruments in the energy sector now, and a lot of the time, yeah, as you said, new terms are introduced, new definitions are added, and they're different across the regulatory instruments. We saw it with the DMO that came through a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
There was references to types of customers, distribution networks, and those definitions weren't the same as what's in the supply acts for the various states or the retail law. And then we saw the new New South Wales retail derogation that talked about vulnerable customers.
Yeah, and I think, you know, and maybe you can talk a bit more about that, but, you know, the practical consequence of that is, not only a bit of confusion by the people who have to comply with those obligations, which isn't necessarily a bad thing for us because it keeps us in the job, but there are also practical consequences in terms of, for example, an energy customer needing to differentiate between a vulnerable customer and a hardship customer, and the need to be able to identify one as opposed to the other, and that involves training customer service representatives and also system changes so that a retailer can make sure that they don't or do take particular action against a particular customer category. So maybe do you mind explaining the July or June amendments to the New South Wales?
Yeah, I think it came in June, but it was, just an amendment to the regulations. So it sort of snuck through because it was just the executive government that made the change. I think the new New South Wales Energy Minister, Matt Keane, used to be
your local
my
member.
Local member, not anymore. But previously, I think he has a good understanding of the space just because he was, I think, in his previous term the Minister for Innovation and Better Regulation, whatever that means, but he definitely was active in the embedded network space. We know that. I think a lot of people listening will probably know about the prohibition on remote disconnection of smart meters in New South Wales at the moment. So that was intended to end at the start of, I think at the start of July this year, and they've extended that for at least another year. And sort of at the same time, the New South Wales government has introduced this new derogation to the New South Wales Energy Retail Law, which essentially prohibits the charging of disconnection and reconnection fees for vulnerable customers. And the definition of vulnerable customer, like, that's not something that's mentioned in the national law.
Mm-hmm.
It's a new creation by the New South Wales government, it looks like. And so it's sort of an umbrella definition which captures hardship customers, but it also includes life support customers. Like yourself, Connor, as you're coughing away there, concession recipients. And then concession recipients is actually defined itself. So, like, it's not like an easy one for retailers to comply with.
No.
And then there's also the exception that if it's for non-payment and you've followed all the proper processes, then you can still charge the fee.
Mm.
Strange. It's a strange one. And, like, it's where we're seeing this more and more. And it's like we were sitting here this time last year talking about the ACCC report that came out. And one of the major recommendations was they want to see uniformity across all jurisdictions. Mm. And since then, I don't see how that's happened. We saw all, like, the raft of changes come through in Vic.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, it seems like each jurisdiction is just continuing to do its own thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, when Victoria adopts the National Energy Customer Framework, I'll go on holiday. And the other example, I think the important example, was the difference between explicit informed consent and informed consent.
Yeah,
that's not very helpful.
That was another one. And that wasn't necessarily a state government.
No.
That was the AEMC themselves, who we love.
Mm-hmm.
We like the AEMC. They do a good job.
We do.
But yeah, that was a strange one to have just informed consent that doesn't need to be
explicit,
or was it explicit consent that doesn't need to be informed?
I don't know. I don't see how you can drop any of those words. All right, so maybe we'll move over to the legal stuff.
Great.
And which is kind of related, but we spoke a little bit about Australian consumer law this week. Do you want to give us an introduction without me telling you that I was going to do this to Section 18?
Section 18 of the Australian Consumer Law. I think I studied this at uni. but that's the misleading and deceptive conduct provision, right? So it's got a few elements. I know when you do, I think this is, like, definitely a mandatory component of any law student's legal education. But it's sort of this catch-all provision of the consumer law, which sort of branches across both tort and contract, and it's aimed at misrepresentation. So it captures any conduct that's in trade or commerce. So there's a couple of definitions that it has to be satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
What is trade? What is commerce? I think we even looked at cases that examined what was conduct. but no conduct in trade or commerce that is misleading or deceptive or likely to mislead or deceive.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that's coming back to me is that it does not matter whether it was intentional or not.
Mm.
Doesn't matter if the person engaging in that conduct actually intended for it to mislead a consumer, as long as it did or it was likely to, then that's captured, and the penalties can be quite substantial, mm-hmm. I believe.
Yeah, so we looked at a 2015 case, which I think is still quite important, and it sort of relates to non-compliance as a result of financial incentives. And so that was the ACCC versus Energy Australia. It's Friday afternoon.
We're in the United States, mate.
That's right. So that was handed down on the 27th of March, 2015, and it concerned conduct by a sales representative company called Bright Choice Australia, who were telesales agents. And it's interesting to look at because it's certainly something that we've been involved in terms of looking at the risk of representatives of a company and the ways in which you can control that risk and whether those controls are adequate. So in this case, Energy Australia had a services agreement that was pretty comprehensive. So it set out the territories where Bright Choice could conduct telemarketing. It included a whole bunch of obligations in relation to compliance, usual obligations to exercise particular standard of care, skill and judgment, and general obligation to comply with all laws and standards. It required that Bright Choice use approved scripts that were provided, and that Bright Choice establish, implement, and maintain a quality assurance and control program that was subject to EA's approval. So EA provided training material that was used by Bright Choice, and that covered our favorite obligation, which is the obligation to obtain explicit informed consent. Bright Choice was required to make call recordings of all outbound telephone calls, and that's a question we're often asked. You know, do we have to take recordings of individual calls or parts of calls? So in this case, all recordings were taken, and they were required to keep those calls for 2 years, which relates to Rule 46, I think.
40-something.
Yeah. Which is that you maintain records of explicit informed consent for 2 years.
40.
Yeah, I was going to say that. And an obligation that they listen to at least 2% of the total number of calls that were made every calendar month. So then Energy Australia conducted train the trainer sessions, which is one of those kind of phrases that I don't like. and training material was provided. So then what happened? Well, I guess the first question is, do you think those controls would be adequate? And, you know, in my view, they're pretty decent controls. So what happened then was Bright Choice went to town and achieved many, many sales. EA increased their base fee from $120, increased it by $35, whatever that is, $155 for a resi customer.
Well done.
Which is sort of pretty much standard from what I understand. And then Bright Choice went around and contacted a whole bunch of consumers, and in some way or form misrepresented that the consumers would be sent a welcome pack, which I think is under Rule 64.
Well done. You Thank got that you. One, mate.
Yes. and so that's the disclosure information. The misrepresentation was that the welcome pack was effectively an invitation to enter into a contract, when in fact the welcome pack was the final step in the contract, or in the formation of the contract that would commence the cooling off period.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to guess Rule 20 something.
Yeah.
22. And So you had a whole bunch of customers who thought that they would have the option to call up Energy Australia and accept an offer when in fact they already had. So in... Sorry, were you going to say something?
Oh, no, yeah. You go on.
Thanks. So then EA self-identified the non-compliance, and because they're compliant people, they reported it to the Australian Energy Regulator in their compliance report under Section 274, the National Energy Retail Law.
Yeah.
And they implemented a remedial program at their own cost of over $950,000.
Wow. And that's an immediate report, isn't it, for explicit informed consent? Or is that...
I think it's a Type 2 report.
Type 2. Yeah. So is that quarterly?
Quarterly report.
Yeah.
Yeah. Type 1 is usually sort of...
Disconnecting.
Yeah. Life support people like me. So then they implemented additional processes... including sending SMSs or emails to every customer who signed up to a contract, and made some changes to their compliance program. The changes that they made included conducting quarterly certification risk assessment of EIC compliance across the business, providing annually or more often training for directors, officers, employees, representatives and agents of EA whose duties might have brought them into contact with customers or with the obligation to obtain EIC. They appointed a compliance officer with responsibility for overseeing the compliance program. I assume they've probably got more than one, maybe another one. They established a monthly scorecard, which scorecards we're not a huge fan of, to assess the performance of third-party vendors. And more importantly, they ensured that all third-party telesales calls were recorded in their entirety, with random call recordings provided to EA for quality assurance. So, as you said in the beginning, under Section 18 and 29.1, the principle is that conduct is likely to mislead or deceive if there is a real or remote chance that it will do so, and that the conduct is capable of leading a person into error, and that the error or misconception resulted from the conduct.
Right.
So the representations were made in Trade and Commerce, and they also breached Section 38 of the National Energy Retail Law, which required that they obtain explicit informed consent.
Mm-hmm.
So the penalty in that instance, only relating to not a large number of customers, was $1 million.
Right.
And as you said, I think the penalties are sort of based on a per contravention, and I believe it's 1.7 million. It could be more than that now, but it's more lots of money.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, I was going to say, like, when you say you don't like scorecards, why is that? Is that because when we play golf, the number on yours is always too high? Or
I always thought it was good to have a high number.
Not in golf, eh?
Okay. You misled me on the rules of the game. Yeah, well, I think, you know, the other news this week was good old NAB had a whistleblower.
Yeah.
Which I think is pretty interesting. We're talking about the effect of law, you know, new law, new regulation in terms of people's perception.
Yep.
And as many people know, the new whistleblower protections came into place. So whether or not it actually protects people is one question, but the separate question, probably more important question, is whether it encourages people to become whistleblowers. So in the case of NAB, a whole bunch of very sensitive material, correspondence between NAB executives and their auditors or consultants.
Or both.
Question mark. was published.
Yeah, it's pretty juicy stuff.
Yeah, and we're going to do an article on that next week. As much as we like to stay away from financial services, I just don't think we can. They just need our help.
Yeah.
So they had scorecards, and I think it was APRA had commented that they're really not a fan of scorecards. And it ties into another theme of this week, which is like, is part compliance good enough? It's not, right? Like, if you breach the law, then you breach the law. One of the funny things you see in services agreements, KPIs or SLAs relating to compliance, and a common one, they just pick an arbitrary number of 95 to 99%. Let's assume that the KPI is to comply with Australian consumer law 95% of the time. Well, you know, that 5% of non-compliance could cost the company millions of dollars. So that's something that we're going to look into in a bit more detail.
I know we've got to wrap up, but can I just ask you one more thing in relation to the Energy Golf. Australia?
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, I will be playing some golf this weekend. Nice. But, so the court said, like, when they were looking at whether they're, like, the controls were adequate, right?
Mm.
I've got a quote here that they said, given the size of the commissions being paid by Energy Australia and the number of telesales that were made by its agent Bright Choice, its procedures, Energy Australia's internal procedures, were deficient.
Mm-hmm.
So are they saying there's a direct link as to how much money you're paying your agents? And the number of sales they're making as to how extensive your processes have to be?
Yeah, I think that wasn't necessarily an assessment of whether or not they breached the obligation, because that's
separate.
Yeah, that's a separate question.
In terms of the penalty.
Yeah, so it's more about the adequacy of the compliance program.
Mm.
And they made a lot of the fact that EA increased the commissions at a particular point in time, and they really drew a connection between that increase and the conduct.
Right.
Which,
so it's sort of, it's less about the hard law and it's more about trying to teach retailers a lesson, really, to say, look, learn from this, look what's happened when you've increased their commission.
Yeah.
That incentive sort of thing.
I mean, it's no different to dealing with 3-year-olds. We've both got experience of that. No, Alex doesn't have children. So I'm making a disclosure. With your nephew and my...
Good save.
Yeah, thank you. If you incentivize them in the wrong ways, they'll do the wrong things. Simple as that. And it doesn't matter what rules you put around that, they're going to go for the incentive. And that was one of the key findings of the Royal Commission as well. So no matter how good your compliance program is and how many thousands of people you have employed, if you're paying somebody to do something and they can get to that outcome by doing something non-compliant, then you shouldn't be surprised when they actually do it. I think that'll do us for this week, because I want to go home.
It's a deep thought to finish on.
Yeah. Thanks, Alex. Catch you next week.
Sounds good.